I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today, I am delighted to have Michael Hidalgo on the podcast with me, and he's the lead pastor of Denver Community Church. We're going to find out more about that. I'm going to ask him some specific questions, actually, about that, and a little bit more about some of his background leading him to the moment that he came to Denver Community Church, and also what led him to the writing of Changing Faith, Questions, Doubts, and Choices About an Unchanging God. I'm here to tell you a ton of books come across my desk, and a lot of them I just kind of yawn and move on and bless someone else with them, with that book. But Changing Faith stuck with me, and I took it home and started reading it, which doesn't always happen when you get book after book after book coming across your desk. So I hope you think that's high praise, Michael. It at least caught my attention. And as I started reading, it was hard to put down because you were kind of talking to me where I was living at the time. I was having some questions and some doubts and wondering about a number of things. And hey, I grew up in the church, a daughter of a Baptist minister, and then I worked at a large Christian organization for 31 years, and then moved forward into doing this podcast. I was in the broadcast world and certainly knew how to do that and move forward into the podcast world, and that's where I find myself today talking with you. And why don't you kind of let us know how you ended up at Denver Community Church. I think there's a story there because you were telling me before we started recording that it is an inner city, kind of urban, difficult neighborhood. And I think when someone intentionally moves to a place like that, there's a story.
Yes. Well, first, thank you for having me. Thank you for reading my book.
Sure.
That's good news. My wife and I, we moved to Denver 8 years ago. And before we moved, we lived in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and as we were getting ready to move, we took a month between resigning from the position I had in Grand Rapids to moving here, and just began praying and felt compelled to say, God, like, we want to live, not just work, we want to live, we want our lives to be different. And so we began praying for families and for a neighborhood, and within 6 months, we had five families with us, five households. But we had a single woman and a single man and a few families and chose to move into a difficult neighborhood. And our reasoning for that was we want to be able to be with and be among those who are in a place of need, to have solidarity with them and create relationships and friendships with them. And it's interesting because where we live now is only 4 miles from the church building that I came to. And so our church building's in a great neighborhood, but then we just bought a new church building. So we now have two locations, and that's in a really gritty area as well. And I continually find myself compelled by individuals who live in hard places, by individuals who live in such a way where all the things we take for granted, they are constantly aware of and needing every single day.
Okay, I'm here. I'm taking all this in, and people listening are as well. It elicits a whole host of questions, not the least of which is you're married and you have 3 children.
Mm-hmm.
And how old are your children, ages and gender?
Yep, 12-year-old son, 10-year-old daughter, and a 5-year-old daughter. And our 5-year-old daughter is convinced she runs the house, which I think she kind of does.
I was going to say she probably does. That's the party girl, third born. I love it.
Oh yeah,
that's great.
Yes.
But I guess I ask that because I think a lot of us, when feeling that nudge of God to move in a direction like you and your wife did, are going, wait a minute, is this safe? Oh, wait, I have kids. I can't do that yet. Maybe when I'm an empty nester. Or, you know, I think we struggle saying yes when it's something that might cost us something or might be a little dangerous or, yeah. I mean, you talked to me just before we started recording about your son's school going on lockdown one day. You know, that those kind of things scare us when we hear that.
Yeah, and I think what's often scary is an unknown future. That's the most terrifying thing for us, is if we don't know what's coming next.
Yeah.
That's when we're scared. And the reality is, if we're really honest, none of us know what's coming next.
True.
Like I have a lunch plan for today, but I really don't actually know that. And so I think what happens is we always talk about a new normal. When we moved into the neighborhood, people would come visit and be like, man, this neighborhood's kind of scary. And we'd be like, oh, it's not that bad. And then they would say, well, like, is there crime? And we would find ourselves telling, oh, yeah, well, there's this story. There's a day our babysitter called and the SWAT team was in our backyard with, like, full assault rifles. And people start freaking out. Yeah. And then we're kind of like, are we the ones who are crazy? Because this becomes normal. And, I mean, I've said things like crime actually brings a neighborhood together. We meet more neighbors when there's an event that goes down.
Sure.
Because everyone comes out when the police show up and we all start chit-chatting. We had a drunk driver go through our yard and four of our neighbors' yards last year at 65 miles an hour and hit a tree. And my wife, who's a nurse, ends up getting the guy out of the car, starting to ask him questions medically, just as the firefighters and ambulance is showing up. People are coming out, confusion's raining, and it ends up with our neighbors bringing us bottles of wine because we have a friend who has like a business that cleans up yards. So I'm like, hey, can you come clean up our yard and clean up our neighbor's yard? So there's this thing of like, I can't believe you live in a neighborhood on a busy street where cars go through your yard. And then there's the other side that goes, yeah, but when that happens, we have a chance to be with our neighbors.
It's like community out of tragedy, right?
Right. And so I think there is that thing of like, there is the reality of safety. There was one neighborhood we looked at and we spoke with law enforcement and they were like, there are bullets flying all the time here. I would not move here. And we said, you know what? Let's look elsewhere. And so we moved on the very fringe of that neighborhood.
Okay.
But we just said, I think, like, this is what we're supposed to do. And so when you step into it and you live in it and it becomes normal, the fear is removed. So there was fear. There was concern. There was, what is this going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also the side of, let's go and do it. And I think the big thing is doing it together. We live right next door to some of our best friends.
Okay. That's no small thing. And you didn't make this decision in a vacuum. This was not you going, all right, my dear wife, we're going to go do that. You know, you this is a family decision besides in the context of community, which you're just now starting to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think one of the things that's so often missed within Western Christianity is the entire Bible. They don't, like, there's very few pronouns that are singular.
Yeah.
So when Paul is writing and when Jesus is speaking and in the Hebrew scriptures, when they use the word you, it would be like when the Southern people say all y'all.
Yes.
Like it's everybody.
Yes.
And so for us, community is central. And so moving into this neighborhood alone would have been pretty concerning. But, you know, when there's, you know, there was one night, for example, where our block got closed down because there was an armed robbery suspect that fled into an abandoned house on our street. And I'm texting with our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going, okay, what's going down? What's going on? And there is that sense of we're here together.
Yeah.
It's going to be okay. And so often when we sense a nudge, rather than say, okay, God, what are you saying? We shut it down.
Yes.
And maybe we say, hey, God, what are you saying? And who else are you saying this to?
Mm.
And maybe for those who are listening, you're a part of a faith community, a part of a local church, and you have these things stirring in you. And the chances are there's someone else in that room on a Sunday morning or in your small group or who has the same idea. And when you begin talking about it, what I'm finding more and more is other people raise their hand and they go, hey, I have the same thing going on. Because I think God is always speaking to everyone.
Yes.
And when we can connect with each other, far more gets done than if we go at it alone.
Yeah. Wow. I thank you for giving us the background of who you are, where you are now, and how you got where you are. I think that's important. And I'm curious, on the heels of you telling us all that, really, what moved you in the direction of writing Changing Faith? Again, subtitle, Questions, Doubts, and Choices About an Unchanging God. Was it that particular move or encountering things once you moved to ministry there in Denver? Or was this something brewing before all that?
I think it's both. Some of it is, a lot of my own story is in there of, I'm just naturally curious, which is both good and really annoying and bad at times, right?
Well, I'm that way, and my husband says the same thing. That's really good, and you're sometimes very annoying.
Exactly. I just want to know how things work. So yeah. Part of it is I grew up asking questions all the time and oftentimes encountering resistance from people when I would ask questions.
Sure.
And then as I've more recently begun to write and travel and speak and connect with people from around the country and in different pockets of culture and people both inside who are a part of a local church and those who want nothing to do with God, what I keep finding is a lot of people are asking the same questions, just using different words. And so as I began to recognize this from college campuses to local churches to like small groups, whatever it was, I would start going like, man, there's a lot of themes here. And so I just began writing and kind of documenting, here are the questions I'm hearing the most, and here's what I'm saying, and here's how I'm responding and interacting with the questions. And one of the things I found is when I would give a hard, concrete answer to these difficult questions, it was always met with suspicion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But when I could say, okay, you're asking this question, and what if we kind of turn the corner a little bit, or maybe if we look at it from this angle, what then?
Yes.
And I began to realize that if I could act as a guide, or if I could ask another question, or if I could reflect back what they're asking, that's when people were like, yes, let's keep going. And well, so that's really where the book came from.
And I'm just going to add into that, that I, you know, I grew up in a conservative stream of evangelicalism where the only thing that was acceptable, and this is a broad brush stroke statement, of course, but mainly what was acceptable was certainty. There are things that are this way and this way and right and right and right, and there are certainly things that are wrong, and it's this way or no way. And a real fear of anything other than what was black and white. And so when I started having some of my own questions and, you know, that made me kind of ponder in the gray areas a little bit, people around got a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, and I think I've had people say to me, you know, I was just with a friend last night who said, you know, I'm a black and white kind of guy. And he said, and I know you're really gray. To which I said, no, I don't do black and white or grayscale. I live in a world of vibrant color.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
I do think what's interesting to me about the right and the wrong and the certainty and the questions is I look at my kids. So I have a 12-year-old middle schooler who's in the throes of adolescence. He's moving from concrete realities to picking up the abstract world in which we live.
Right.
And then I have a 5-year-old. And so my 12-year-old, what's interesting is the more he grows and learns and understands about the world, that's actually causing more questions, deeper questions, and better questions. My 5-year-old still accepts everything that is said to her at face value.
Yes.
And so that's where I say, I think it's actually a mark, and I talk about this in the book, that it's a mark of growth and depth and trust. As we learn more about God, there are necessarily going to be more questions.
Well, here's...
And, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, here's the deal. I was stunted in my growth for a long time. And I think sometimes in the church, we keep people in a stunted place if we don't allow these broader conversations. I think we can be, some are, driven by fear. But I think it's more, and to quote you, you say in the book, whenever we attempt to make God more like us, and I think that's what happens sometimes, there's a good chance we become less like him. You know, we must remember God does not observe all the dividing lines we have set up, and man, we can set up a lot of them. And that's been my past, and as I've kind of moved to a little bit different place, I've seen my view of God change and expand in ways that are not scary. I once thought it might be, but it, you know, I've loved how God has dealt gently with me along the way.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the one of the things that I find interesting, we're right now at Denver Community Church doing a whole teaching series through the Gospels.
Mm.
And I've been continually challenged when you use the word expand at how Jesus is always, he's not just like observing the boundaries or stepping over them. He's like, this is like a massive full-on air assault on all of the boundaries set up. And to the point where, like, you can't even tell it was there before the bombing started. And he's pushing out, and he's always doing so from a position of saying, God is in hot pursuit of everybody.
Mm.
And there's no one on this earth who has the breath of God in their nostrils that God rolls his eyes at and says, well, I'm kind of done with you. And so that's the place where, so if God's pursuing everyone, then God is a present, real reality in all places at all times. And just that thought alone begins to really expand what we consider and what we're able to even begin processing about God.
Well, you, to quote you again, you know, you say the only boundaries that exist with regard to the love of God are ones we create. That's a beautiful statement. But it's a big statement that we have a hard time getting our arms around. This whole idea that, you know, God pursues everyone is hard to grasp. We want to become more like that, but that might mean I might have to change. That's big. I mean, that's a big statement to become more like that. When I'm struggling with that thought, we've all got a lot of growth in this area.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the continual invitation of God. And this is the continual invitation of Jesus.
Yeah.
You're holding on to these things that bring you, you used the word earlier, security and certainty, that bring you this security and certainty. But God is this loving Father who's going, listen, I need you to let go and jump. I need you to let go and take a leap and trust me.
Yeah.
I love the line in Chronicles of Narnia when they're first talking about Aslan, and they say, you know, he's really wild. And there's this sense of like, this is how God is. God is really wild. His love puts us in a place of complete and total powerlessness. And that's the place, and those are the ways in which we have to let go, trust, take a leap, surrender. And I think that's the difficulty, is God is continually gently reminding us, you're not in control.
Yeah. Oh, man, I don't like that kind of world.
Exactly.
Right. And that's what can be troubling and where we can really, I think, begin to struggle. And I think also where a great avenue of growth is for most of us. And I think most of us don't actually start to move into that realm of a more expansive view of God until some kind of crisis hits our life.
Absolutely.
And I'm curious if was the case for you. I mean, you've told about this amazing move that you and your family made into this neighborhood. But, you know, anything else that was kind of an inciting incident that really started to expand your thinking and mind about God?
Oh, well, yeah, there was the exciting move here. But then there was also the non-exciting move from the East Coast to the Midwest, which really confused me as a kid who was 13 years old.
Oh, yeah.
But then for me, there were two great sources of pain in my life. Mm. And I think great pain, great suffering,
yes,
and great love are the two great teachers.
Yes.
And one of them was I planted a church. I launched the church, and the wheels came off 8 months in. There was betrayal. There was wounding. We lost friends. My reputation was questioned, and any major sin that you can think of that a pastor would be in trouble for, there was word out that I had done one of those things, if not all of them, none of which was true.
Wow.
And then the other source, which I actually write about in the last chapter of Changing Faith, is me and my dad. It was a horrible, difficult, strained relationship. We refer to a time where we didn't speak for several years as our troubles.
Wow. Wow, I haven't finished the book yet, so I didn't get that far. Oh, no kidding. No, tell me.
I said spoiler alert.
No, I want to hear this. That's huge. That's huge.
Yeah, and yeah. So for me, in the words of Paul Young, it took a lot of years for me to wipe the face of my own father off the face of God.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And okay. What happened was my wife finally said, "You have got to get help. Like, this is not working, you and your dad." Mm. And unbeknownst to me, in this time when my father and I were not speaking, someone who loves my father very much said, "You need to go get help." Hmm. And the reunion and the renewal that we had the first time we spoke after years of silence, in the transformative power of what God had done in my heart and in my dad's heart. Hmm. And now, like, he just called me yesterday and he's like, "Hey, I got this great story for you." And so he tells me this story about a conversation he has with this guy about me and him, huh. And then finishes and goes, "Isn't it great that our story is now giving back to other people?"
Oh, wow.
I'm like, oh, like in tears driving.
Absolutely.
You know? So there's this reality of that pain is either going to transform us,
yeah,
or pain is something that we're going to hold on to and then we will transmit it to other people.
Yeah.
And I think when I look at that pain, I go back to community. Like when I got, when the church plant fell apart, I had people, like one of my friends would call me every day at 7:30 and keep calling me until I picked up the phone and say, "Get out of bed today."
Yeah. Okay.
And I look at another friend of mine who would stop by my house every day on his way home from work. "How was today? How are you doing? How are you feeling loved? How are you?" And so when I talk about this transformation, it was because the people of God came around me and said, we believe in you and love you far too much to let you waste away beneath this pain and beneath this suffering.
Mm. But it's in the middle of that kind of pain and suffering that these doubts can creep in, do creep in. I won't say can. I think they do. If you're in that space and time of suffering, and I guaranteed lots of folks are that are, you know, listening to the podcast right now, whether it's a physical deal, emotional, mental, mm-hmm. spiritual, whatever, they all touch each other. Doubts creep in, and that's a place where we struggle, because I think oftentimes we've been taught that doubts can be or are the enemy, but it's actually an essential part of our life and growth in our relationship with Christ. And say something about that. Talk about that doubt component that does enter in.
Yeah, I would say two things from Scripture that are compelling to me. First, the entire book of Psalms. we sing 50% of the Psalms on Sunday, and it's typically happy, happy, joy, joy.
Yeah, there you go.
But the other 50% are, "God, where are you?
Yeah.
God, why are you hiding from me?
Lament.
Darkness is my only friend."
Yep.
And I'm like, we don't sing those songs, but right. I know when I stand up on a Sunday morning, there's a lot of men and women in our congregation that want to sing the lament.
Yes.
And the thing I love about the Psalms is it teaches us and invites us to say, "Make your doubts known." Mm-hmm. And when they're saying, "God, why are you far away?" they're not saying, "It feels like you are, but I know you're not and I shouldn't ask." Mm. They're actually saying, "You are far away. I'd like to know why." Mm. The other piece is doubting Thomas, which we always talk about like Debbie Downer.
Yeah.
And we roll our eyes. But what's fascinating to me is in Luke, he says, when the women return from the tomb and tell the 11 Jesus was resurrected, their words sounded to the 11 like nonsense. And then it says in Matthew, when Jesus is ascending to heaven, so now they've seen him, he's resurrecting, he's going up. It says some worshiped, some doubted. The only one who raises his hand and says, "I'm going to talk about the fact that I have doubt," is Thomas. Hmm. And the thing that I love is he's the only one that we actually hear about who gets to touch the wounds, the saving wounds. He's the only one who gets to touch them.
Ooh.
In the entire Gospels.
That is a
And so
great
if you're
point.
Listening and you're crying out and everything in you is saying, "Why, God?" There's no answers. There's nothing to go on. All of your belief systems have shattered. The hope is when you shout that out in the tradition of the psalmist, in the tradition mm-hmm. of Thomas, Jesus will say, "If you need to touch the wounds, go ahead." Because I think sometimes we need to touch the wounds.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. There is so much more in this book, but that is the place we need to end today. I think that's a powerful thought, and I think there's some folks that need to hear that. Oh, Michael, I wish I was sitting in your congregation on Sunday mornings. You can preach.
Well, we do have a podcast, so if that helps you.
That's awesome. Others. Absolutely. I'm going to put that in the show notes, along with how folks can find their way there and find their way to your website. And we'll get all of that down in the show notes. And folks know if they're missing anything, they can just head to anitalustria.com and find it all there. What a delight to have you with us today.
Well, thank you.
I honestly, there are so many more talking points, and guaranteed you're going to get a call back from me to be back on the podcast. This is good stuff.
Sounds great. It's been really fun being with you. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm Anita Lustria, and you've been listening to Faith Conversations.